Hi, I'm an alcoholic, and my name's Bryce.
Bryce.
I'm really glad to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity to come and serve at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. If there's anybody new here, and new to Alcoholics Anonymous, and new to hearing people come up here and talk, please don't make a decision to leave based on what I say, because really, I'm just one of many, many alcoholics that are going to come up and share their stories and experience, strength, and hope in Alcoholics Anonymous to help you be able to relate in. And what we're trying to do here is hopefully give you the opportunity to relate into a meeting and a person in Alcoholics Anonymous so that you hopefully will keep coming back and experience what we experience here in AA, and that is a sober life and the opportunity to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. Because really, it may not sound like much right now, but it's really, you know, it's the rocket fuel in everybody's rocket, you know, to get them and to have them live a spiritual way of life. And that has happened to me. And my past, I really drank and lost my mind. I did some things that, you know, you may not like, you know, but I don't regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. I'm not embarrassed or ashamed of where I went and what I did. But I am very grateful for the opportunity to make amends on a spiritual level to God and to my fellow human beings. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about myself. And I started to drink alcohol when I was about 8 years old. And my old man, and forgive me, because I may, you know, say dame or broad or my old man, and, you know, that's just the way I talk and from where I come from, and so, and how I relate to other people. And my old man was a drunk, and he drank, he loved beer, and in the basement, you know, that you could see from the living room, he had a separate refrigerator, and every Friday, he would buy 10 cases of beer, and maybe the neighbor would come over, and him and the neighbor would drink beer, and maybe they wouldn't. But all I knew is that I was gonna, you know, and it was Friday, and I just felt like a kid. I was running home from elementary school. I was in the third grade. And I remember, you know, my old man saw me looking in the fridge, and I was really, you know, I wasn't sure if there was any other food in there, but, and he said, if I ever catch you touching my beer, I'm gonna break your arm. And, I believed him. He was that kind of guy. And, I remember really, really well just opening the refrigerator door, because when he said, don't go over there, don't do that, don't talk to that person, don't hang out over there, that meant that's where the fun was, you know, and my ass was going right over there, you know, and he would always catch me, you know, I told you not to go over there, and, you know, well, you know, that was a hint, Dad, you told me, you know, that's where the good stuff is, and so that's where I would end up, and, you know. And, you know, so I liked it. I hung out with, you know, anyway, I grabbed a six-pack of beer and went over to my elementary school. It was called Garrett Park Elementary School, and it was surrounded by woods with this big field in the middle. And I sat over, there was a big rock there, and I sat over by the rock, and I heard somebody coming, and I had a six-pack of my old man's beer, and this kid was coming over, and he had miniatures of J&B Scotch that he swiped from his old man. And I only knew him by his name, but his old man owned a bus touring company. And in Washington, back in them days, you could sell, you know, miniatures of J&B and gin and all that other crap. And on the bus, and I didn't really, you know, I didn't think anything of it. He was like, you know, let's drink beer and booze and scotch. And I was like, you know, cool. And the next thing I know, you know, I had a couple beers and a couple scotches, and I was drunk as a skunk, and then we're sitting there listening, and we heard some kids breaking windows over at the elementary school, and I got up, and, you know, I'm this big, and the other guys were like, you know, 15, 16 years old, and I'm 8 years old in third grade, and I went over there and picked up a stick and just started two sticks, smashing all the windows out of the school, you know, and running around the school throwing rocks and laughing and having fun, you know, and not even thinking about getting caught. And I was just out of my mind, you know, and the big kids saw me, you know, I kind of got spooked and ran away. And then, you know, I'm tired because I broke about 400 windows out of this elementary school. And I'm standing there just looking at my artwork, and the cops pulled up. And they came running over to me, and because I was only this big, they were like, what happened, you know, and the big kids, they ran that way, you know, and the cops went chasing these kids, and the kids had left like 20 minutes, half hour before me, and the cops caught them, and they were, you know, they said, no, that little kid did it all, and, you know, my name was in the paper, you know, Bryce McNaughton breaks windows at elementary school, I got my first arrest. At 8 years old, the cops came. They took me to the police station with my parents. You know, it was a big deal. My parents had to pay hundreds of dollars for all these windows I broke, and I just, you know, that was just the beginning of what my lovely parents were about to experience from, you know, their little devil. And, you know, I just, you know, and when everywhere, you know, and then I'm 8 years old, I go over to Susie's house or, you know, Johnny's house, and you know, hi, Ma, it's, you know, me and Bryce are here. And they're like, Bryce who? You know, and all this, Bryce, you know, blah, blah, blah. No, you can't hang out with that guy. And, you know, so I became the guy that, you know, your mom didn't want you hanging out with. And for good reason, because as life went on, you know, I ended up in the paper and on TV more than once. And I think, you know, I was 9. I shot one of my friends with a BB gun, and his mom told. And, you know, next thing you know, it turns into this big story, you know, and Bryce, you know, shooting people with his BB gun and breaking lights and shooting out street lights and drinking beer late at night and sneaking out with my friends. And, you know, there was a whole little army of us that kind of, you know, were doing that kind of thing. And I was in elementary school, and when I turned 9, the teacher just was, couldn't hang with me anymore. You know, she said, you know, there's something wrong with your kid. And they kept having my parents come in to teacher conferences. And they said, you know, what his problem is that he's hyperactive. They brought me to a doctor. And a lot of you look about the age that, you know what Dexedrine is, and that's what they put me on. But my parents didn't know what Dexedrine was, so they would give me the vial, and I went to school with a vial of Dexedrine, and I'd trade them for cookies and, you know, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, milk, and, you know, whatever I wanted. And to the kids that were in sixth grade, and I just, I really didn't care, you know, I was too young, you know, I didn't know what I was doing or what was going on. I just liked the attention, and I liked having friends, because my old man was a violent drunk, and he was a torturous violent drunk. And, you know, he broke my bones and my fingers one day, because the teacher called and said that he thought I had stolen a ruler. And so when he got home, you know, he came home early, already loaded, and he took my fingers and broke them all and beat me, you know, with a stick. And, you know, he was a violent, violent guy. And so was my brother. And so they both would gang up on me. And but I turned out to, you know, I wanted to, I didn't turn out like that. And I drank a lot of booze, and I just wanted to have friends. Because at home, there was no friends there. You know, there was nobody there that I could go and hang out with and have fun with. And my dad would make me hang out with him, you know. And, come on, we're going golfing. Here, go get the balls, you know. And he would hit the balls, and I'd have to go chase him. And, you know, it was just like, this sucks, you know. And so hanging out at the house and hanging out with my parents was punishment. You know, it wasn't fun time. We didn't do anything. You know, it wasn't their fault. It was just, he was a drunk too, and, you know, alcoholism, and alcohol takes me places that I don't ever want to go, and I do things that I would never do without it. And, you know, I just became somebody that I didn't like, and Alcoholics Anonymous taught me to forgive people that became what I didn't like in them, and I have, you know. And my old man, when I was 11, I got Dexedrine, and, you know, I always had Dexedrine in my pocket, but I didn't know it was speed, because when I took it, it made me sleepy. And it didn't do to me what it does to regular people. That's why they still give it out to people that are, you know, they call it Ritalin. And when I was a kid, I didn't care. They just kept giving it to me, and I kept trading it. And then as time went on, got a little bit older, you know, I drank a few beers with a friend of mine that lived across the street, right across the street. And me and him were best buddies, and a guy named Sergeant Shriver was running for vice president. He lived just down the street from where we lived, and was having this huge, huge party for labor. And me and him went over there. You know, we wanted to steal. You know, I was into stealing, and back then just stealing and drinking. And I wanted to, you know, steal some beers and get some free beers. And, you know, that's exactly what happened. And we were leaving and laughing. And, you know, we had swiped a couple of drunks' wallets because it was a labor thing and there was people passed out everywhere. And we swiped a couple of wallets and we're laughing our butts off. And on the way out, we looked and there was keys in the car. And, you know, I'm 11 years old. My buddy's 10, you know, and he's like, let's steal this car. And, you know, I just, okay, you know, I mean, why think? And we jumped in his car and, you know, drove out of this guy's driveway down the road. And we had this car for about 2 weeks. We smashed it in the trees. We hit it in the bushes, in the woods. You know, we drove down this bike path, motorcycle path. And, and hid the car down there, and just we were having such a good time running over people's hedges and taking them out at night and sideswiping other cars and doing stuff you wish you could do now. You know, all those orange things. You know, and it was a lot of fun. And then we thought, you know, well, we better not keep it till we get caught. And we drove it into the other neighborhood across the tracks and, you know, left the keys in it and the window down. And sure enough, you know, one of those kids took the car and got caught 2 days later. And me and my buddy are like, you know, yay, you know, because they don't have to look for us anymore. And you know, it was just, it was a lot of fun. You know, drinking was a lot of fun when I was a little kid. You know, my old man made it not look fun. He was not a nice guy, but I was going to do it different, you know, and I was going to be different. And what ended up happening is that my judgment of him and my hatred of him dwarfs what I became because of my drinking and what I was. And I got a little older, you know, and I liked to fight, you know, be a part of a gang. And, you know, I went to Kensington Junior High School, which is, and it was a lot of fun. I mean, you know, and they had what's called rumbles. And if you ever saw, you know, West Side Story, it's them against us. And, you know, you go into a tennis court, and you close the gate, and the two schools, you know, battle until, you know, somebody quit, until one school quits. And you had pipes and sticks, and, you know, it was just that, you know, it was fun. back then. But there was always going to be drinking there. You know, Bryce always could bring two cases of beer. My old man wouldn't remember how much he drank. And my mom liked wine a lot, but she drank the crappiest wine, so I couldn't swipe hers. I couldn't even drink it, but every once in a while she'd buy something different, and I'd swipe it from her and blame my brother, who was a minister. And one day we were at a party, and I had brought a couple six-packs of beer from my old man's refrigerator. And we're drinking outside, and somebody else had a bottle of booze, and we're all laughing and talking, you know, about things that we never experienced, and mainly girls. And and a buddy of mine came up to me carrying this huge stereo, you know, and it was early 70s, very early 70s. And he had a couple of bottles of booze in his pocket, and his friends were carrying stuff, you know. And I was like, where'd you get that, man? He said, well, I broke into the house. And, you know, I didn't know what he was talking about, because that, you know, I questioned him. And, you know, I made up my mind that I was going to do that from, you know, forever. I was going to make, that really interested me. And so I started breaking into houses, and you know what happens? It talks about Alcoholics Anonymous, and we grow the fellowship that we crave. And when I'm a drunk, you know, I just attract people like me, people that wanted to fight and have fun and, you know, steal and cheat and break into people's houses. And, you know, and that's what I surrounded myself with at that age when I was about 15. And I just... I didn't see any problems, you know, because it seemed like the badder you were, or the badder people thought you were, the more friends you had, you know, it was popular. And, you know, one time my parents sent me to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist said, you know anybody that doesn't drink or do drugs? And I just was like, yeah, my brother, you know, and I was like, I don't want to be like him. And she said, well, do you know anybody else? Do you hang out with anybody? And I said, no, there isn't anybody at my school. And because I just had a kid come up, you know, say to me, there's nobody that doesn't drink at my school. And I was like, you know, oh, that sounds just like me, man, you know. I can only find the people that do what I do. I can only absorb, you know, take. I could go on to a RFK during a spiritual awakening meeting, and, you know, I could have found the 10 most retarded drug addict drunks, and, you know, and I would have been their leader, and, you know, and it just, you know, I attract people like that, you know, and no matter what, no matter where, and that's what happened. And we ran around, and I started stealing, and one day broke into somebody's house, and there were guns in there, you know, handguns. And so then I became a little kid with handguns and alcohol and people like me that wanted to, you know, we talked about things that hadn't happened yet, and it seemed like we talk about them, and then they happen, and there was guns and alcohol. And I went to a party of a friend of mine, and it was a family party, and there was a guy that was my age that was like 15, and then there was one that was 17, and then his older brother was 21, and his older sister was 23, and it was a huge, you know, a big house. And I noticed some guy going outside, you know, wobbling and carrying a bottle of liquor, and I just picked up something, and, you know, when he went outside, smacked him in the head and stole his wallet and his bottle, and I started drinking, you know, and I just, that never, ever affected me again until recently. And recently what happened was, you know, I had forgotten all about this guy. It didn't even occur to me what kind of damage it could have done to somebody or, you know, I would have never, ever probably had a memory bubble that would have brought that moment forward. And some kid came up and said, hey, will you speak at court for a friend of mine, you know, who's trying to get sober and blah, blah, blah. And I'm not happy about this. And I, you know, it says we don't want to regret the past, but I'm ashamed, you know, and I just said yes without asking. And you know, usually, and I do it often, I go to court for people, but usually I ask or they tell me what the scoop is. And I said, well, what happened? You know, and I did ask, you know, briefly, but I didn't question. And he said, well, it's for assault. And I said, okay. And I went and went, and I'm sitting in the courtroom just like you're sitting there. And the guy that, you know, I was going to talk about, I have seen him before, but he was sitting, you know, where he's supposed to sit. And just before they called my name, you know, to come up and talk, some kid came in with his mom holding him, you know, carrying him, basically. And he sat down next to me and on the other side of the chairs, and his mom sat on the other side. And I looked over, and he had a shaved head, not as shaved as mine, but maybe, you know, just crew cut shaved. And he had stitches like this on the side of his head, and then on the top of his head across here, and then on the other side of his head. And I just got this feeling of just, you know, shame and anger and like, oh my God, you know, I'm going to speak for this guy and I don't believe in him, you know, and I didn't know what to do. And I'm there by myself. There was probably, you know, 20 or 30 young people in there and I turned to the guy next to me. I said, is that the guy he hit? Or that, you know, is that the guy he hurt? And he says, yeah, that is the guy he hurt. And I was like, what did he do? And he said he smacked him in the head with an axe handle. And that is so close to what I smacked this guy in the head with. You know, that I went pale as a ghost. I was about to throw up, you know, because it was me. And as soon as I was about to, you know, I mean, it just was seconds. It was like, and I was like, I'm getting the hell out of here. And just as that happened, Bryce McNaughton, come to the front, please. You know, and I was, and I just took a second. I was like, God help me. And I just walked up to the front. And all I could say was, you know, I really don't know this person that well. But what I can speak about is what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. And God gave me a way, you know. He gave me a way to be able to talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. And maybe somebody else in that courtroom, you know, got something out of that. And I turned around and I walked away. And, you know, after it was all over, you know, I just said, you know, I want you to know I'm really upset, you know, that this has happened. And I feel like I was tricked into this because I did ask you what the situation was. And I got a short answer, and I knew, you know, there was just something there, but I didn't question it, you know, and I was about to blame him for the way I was feeling, and I just stopped and said, you know, it's me, it's my ego, you know, I wanted to be the big shot, I wanted to go to court, you know, I do this, you know, and I just was like, you know, what I used to do for God's grace, I was doing for ego, and it just kicked my butt, you know, and so when I tell that story of this guy that I whacked in the head, and I have no idea, and there's many others, that's nothing. That's a snowflake in the blizzard compared to, you know, the things I've done and I don't know about. But I just turned away and left him there, just like this kid did. And this guy who whacked him took his, you know, just wanted $100. The guy was in a pizza place, and he was getting $100 out when he smacked him in the head, and The kid, ever since he was in ninth grade, wanted to be in ROTC and wanted to go to the Air Force and wanted to fly a jet. And now he wasn't doing anything. You know, he had 6 or 12 plates in his head and steel bolts in this. I mean, his whole head was smashed in. And you know what? And the guy said, I was drunk. And it gave me a new level of understanding. And I was really grateful for what I learned from that experience. And I don't know what anybody else learned from that experience, but I left there with a greater understanding of what integrity is, you know. And so when I got home, I made these guys that asked me to come and speak to get the address of the victim and his mother. And I wrote them a letter saying how sorry I was, you know, that I didn't understand, and, you know, just I apologized and said if there was anything I could do, you know, please allow me the opportunity to help out, because, you know, the kid who was going to jail was not the victim, you know, and I just lost perspective of my spiritual program and my way of life and focused on my ego. And I'm grateful for AA because, you know, they say AA is very friendly. You know, AA can forgive anything or anybody, and that's the way it's been for me since I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I was, and after I whacked this guy, I then had a license, because back in the early 70s, licenses didn't have pictures or fingerprints or anything else on them. It just said, you know, brown hair, blue eyes, scar on left arm, 5'10", 160, or whatever it was. And, you know, back then I weighed that. And, you know, now one of my legs does. But I, I had a thing, and I went in and could buy alcohol from the county liquor store. And I walked in, and the first day, you know, I had, you know, great attention brought upon me by every employee in the place. And they weren't owners because they're state and county run in Maryland. And, I showed this guy an ID, and he goes, "That's not you." And the other guy came over, my heart was going. I mean, I was like 15 years old, trying to buy Southern Comfort because girls liked it. And I went in there, and he goes, "That's not you." And the two guys got in an argument. Then other employees got in, and you know, I just slammed my fist down on the thing, and I was like, "Look, here's the scar, here's the eyes, here's 5'10", here's 160. Give me the, you know," and I just was, "Hey, I was going to get kicked out anyway." And they all just looked at me, and he goes, "You don't even have any hair on your face." And I said, "I'm an American Indian. Are you discriminating against me?" And, you know, he just, and I ended up, and I could go there, and I was there at 9 o'clock every morning before school started. You know, buying a pint, 2 pints, 3 pints, whatever the girls and my buddies wanted. Then we drive up to Dickerson, Maryland, and go swimming. And, you know, all the time people were jumping into Dickerson's, drowning, you know, and getting too drunk. But everybody thinks it's not going to be them, you know. And then finally it was one of my buddies that drank too much and did too much and was having so much fun that he jumped in the water and drowned. And, you know, that's what happens. And, you know, you remember it for a day, maybe two, and, you know, and then a couple days later, I'm drinking again, and, you know, stuff happened. And just shortly after that, I went to a big, big party at a place called the Tilden Rec Center, which is in Rockville, Maryland. And there was a couple hundred of us, probably 300 people. And a buddy of mine who has been to jail many times at forestry camp and, you know, just always in trouble. Because he was almost 7 feet tall and he was 15 years old and as big as a doorway. I mean, he was a giant. And so it's hard when you run away it was that guy, you know, and when you're that big. And he got caught all the time anyway. And me and him were drinking out of a bottle and we got in a fight and he lost. And he said he was going to kill me. And, you know, you don't believe him. You say that all the time. You know, "I'm going to kill you." And, well, he wasn't kidding. And he came back to kill me, but instead killed the guy next to me, you know, and stabbed him. And the bottle went under the arm and cut an artery and bled to death. And we were 15. I was in ninth grade, the summer of ninth grade. Or maybe it was ninth grade. And high school hadn't started yet. And my buddy died. My name was in the paper for probably the third or fourth time. You know, Bryce McNaughton, murder, you know, stabbing, rec center, alcohol, drugs, you know, and just, and what was happening was nobody was making me, you know, an outsider. I was doing it, you know, but I wanted to blame everybody. It's easier to be a victim. I have something to drink at, you know, and when I think that I'm doing what I think you're doing to me, you know, then I there's nowhere to go, you know, and so I just didn't, you know, I started high school and had already been in the paper and on the news, and everybody's parents already knew me and my name, you know, there was the jocks and the freaks and everybody else wasn't important, and you know, we were all just hanging out, and you know, and it was them, you know, and I just, you know, I was in high school doing drugs, and as far as I was concerned, well, as looking back, you know, I was popular because people want to be your friend when they're afraid of you, and you know, I had broken into many houses, and by then hurt many people. I was only 15 years old, and I always thought there was other people that were badder than me, you know, but. I was going downhill fast. And my parents didn't know what to do. My grandparents were, you know, can we help? Can we do anything? My parents, you know, let me send you to a doctor. Let me send you to the psychiatrist. And, you know, there was just nothing happening. I'd go see a doctor and, you know, why are you here? Because they sent me, you know, and just I didn't want to be there, so I didn't participate. My poor parents were throwing away money. And 10th grade, you know, this girl liked me, and I liked her back, and then, you know, we broke up, and I ended up taking a handful of pills that my mom had, and that was my first introduction to the psych ward. I was 15, and that was one of many, many, many trips to the psych ward, you know, where my drinking got me. And I just drank over it and constantly had parties. You know, my parents would go, they'd go to 7-Eleven, and I'd call people, and there'd be 150 people at the in the house by the time they got back, you know, and they would just be like, you know, what is going on? And my buddy lived right across the street, so, you know, they could stay in the street, and, you know, we just put our speakers in the windows and, blah, you know, and people drinking in the street and music, and, you know, I thought it was fun, but my parents weren't too hip. And when I, my old man was still beating me and, you know, acting like he was acting, and just I had a field party. I said, you know, we're going to have a field party, and so I bought 20 bottles of Yango Sangria and a couple cases of beer. Then I'm walking. And back then, I mean, I used to lift weights. When I was about 8, my dad locked me in the basement in a room, and I had a hate for him that I could not cure. And I used to lift weights at 8 years old, and for years I was what he called put into jail. And I wasn't allowed to leave that room, you know, a little room, a hard floor like this. And so I wanted to kill him. And many times he caught me, you know. One time he was beating me and knocked over a chair. And one of those guns I told you about, I forgot, I had under a chair because I was going to shoot him. And he found the handgun and beat me some more. And then he caught me sneaking in his room with a knife. I wanted to stab him in the chest. Because, you know, I was blaming everybody else for the way I was feeling. You know, and yes, he was sick, but goddamn, man, you know, so was I. And there was two sick people banging heads with each other all the time, you know, and I was in his house being drunk, you know, and I never thought I'd be cured or helped or have any solution for the hate I had for him. And as I got a little older, you know, the things I was doing were 10 times worse than what he was doing to me, you know, and I ended up finally doing a lot of stealing and a lot of lying. I broke into houses. They were building White Flint Mall, and we lived near there. And, you know, from as soon as they started building it, I was walking around inside and looking around. And as soon as they were finished, Elizabeth Taylor came and opened it up, and I broke in, you know. And then I was going around this this place and stealing all the time from jewelry stores, fur stores, leather stores, shoe stores, you know, just giving the crap away. Because what I didn't know was happening was that I was drinking away my self-esteem and my personality. I was drinking away my ability to be me, because all I was whatever I drank, I became, and it was always something I didn't know about. You know, I was never the nice guy. I was never, you know, I used to break into my friends' houses steal their parents' credit cards and then bring everybody out to dinner and drinks, you know, and they would think, you know, what a great guy you are, and, you know, and then I throw the credit cards in the garbage or, you know, just steal from everybody. And because I drank myself hollow, you know, there was just nothing there. And after that, I've been to jail a lot, and I got one of my friends got arrested and told the police, you know, if they didn't send him to jail, he would, you know, give him this laundry list of stuff that I had done. And we were, like, in the same gang. We were pretty close. It was, you know, the Brotherhood of Thieves. And he ratted me out, and the cops came to my parents' house. And, you know, I forget how many felony arrests there were, but there was a lot. And, again, I on the news, in the paper, you know, big trouble, big drag. You know, my father's name is Bryce McNaughton. His father's name is Bryce McNaughton. His father, my grandfather, came over on the boat from Scotland, you know, with, you know, this image of integrity and self-respect that you only see on pompous television shows. I mean, it was so unreal how. But what happened was that it was my grandfather that beat and tortured my father who passed it on to me, you know. And so I didn't realize until time went by that, you know, alcoholic, you know, and I just, you know, I was living with that without any knowledge of any solution for that. And I really didn't want one. I wasn't really, alcohol was my solution. And so the cops came with a search warrant. And I remember my mom calling the bar I was at, which was in D.C., and the county cops couldn't come to D.C. back then. And, you know, she said, the police are everywhere. There's a search warrant, and, you know, they're finding all sorts of stolen stuff you had hidden up in the attic. And, you know, the furniture that we have in our living room that you said you gave us for our anniversary, you know, and Oriental rugs, you know, would roll down under the dining room table. And, you know, I mean, shit everywhere. Then the cops came and just took it all out, and they were in the paper, you know. And, you know, I just was constant shame and embarrassment to everybody around me or everybody that knew me. And finally, my friends, you know, my best friend, who's dead now, but I had broken into somebody's house, and this is just, found a couple ounces, a quarter pound of coke and $20,000+ in cash. And I said, you know, come on over, man, we're going to have a good time. And he said, no, we're not going to have a good time. I can't hang out with you, man, because, you know, you could get so high, it's me that you kill, you know. And I understood what he was saying, you know. I was always carrying a gun or a knife, and, you know, just, I went out of my mind. And how I got to Alcoholics Anonymous was that, you know, after all this trouble, and I've been to jail, I've been to many psych wards, they locked a door, it was called the lock unit once I went in, because they knew about my past, and, you know, I carried guns all the time, I drank in blackouts, and I was afraid that I was going to shoot. My girlfriend broke up with me and started going out with the guy that sold me dope, and I said I was going to kill him, so I paid somebody $10,000 to kill him, and, and then I saw this psychiatrist, and he said, if you stop that from happening, you know, because I said, I want pills, I want tranquilizers and sedatives, and, you know, I want to be loaded, man. And he said, you got to stop drinking and stop doing coke. And I said, okay. So he gave me Halcyon and Xanax. This is 25 years ago. And I used to take, you know, he would write me a prescription, and I would go home and take the whole bottle and, you know, pass out and wake up tan and be like, I'm ready for a great time, you know, just in my parents' front yard. And or I'd take, you know, the Halcyon and sleep for, you know, a couple of days, or be in a blackout, and I got arrested not knowing why or what I did. And, you know, I became everything that I accused, you know, that, and I was always looking for somebody worse so I wouldn't be so bad. And pretty soon I was by myself because there wasn't anybody worse, you know. And what happened was, finally, after a year of taking these pills and just, I don't know how many times I got arrested, you know, in public, walking, you know, leaving the house without any clothes on and not knowing it, walking the dog, I mean, just with a cowboy hat on, and, you know, just crazy stuff. The neighbors were afraid of me, you know, that everybody was afraid of me, and I was a whack job, and and when somebody, you know, he said, why don't you try treatment? And I didn't know what that word meant. And, you know, after a little bit of learning, I learned. I went to a suburban hospital. And I tried to do this gig, man, you know. But I was so far gone. I mean, they detoxed me for a few weeks. But it wasn't long enough, you know. Because I couldn't understand what, you know. And I never heard words like sobriety and relationship and, you know, all this stuff that are topics in AA meetings. And I didn't know what that meant. We don't talk that kind of language in jail. And certainly not in a circle of friends that I was hanging out with. And so, you know, I went in there, and it was September 13th. I got drunk, and I have attempted suicide many times. I shot my own self with a gun. I cut my arm, you know, in the artery. Almost lost my left arm, and overdosed on drugs, and rode a bicycle in front of a truck. And you know, I mean, I just, you know, like, what am I doing alive? You know, in front of a whole bunch of people at the bus stop. I remember that one, and. This was the last suicide attempt, was like September 9th or something, and on the 13th, I was going to go to treatment, and, you know, my arm was bandaged up, and the hand, and, you know, was in this kind of position, and I was swearing I was going to tell the truth, you know, and I walked in there, and this nurse about this big, who was just gorgeous, came walking up to me and said, how are you? And I said, fine, you know, and next thing I know, you know, I couldn't tell the truth. I closed the door on that and wanted, you know, tried to be somebody else and, you know, somebody this, and tucked in my shirt and just, you know, it just, I ended up going through treatment and drinking again. I got 4 DWIs in a week, 3 in Maryland, 1 in D.C., or, yeah, you know, and my lawyer was like, you're going back to jail, you're a goddamn loser, and I don't want to have anything to do with you. And I said, you know, if you don't defend me and you don't get me off, I'm going to put a bullet in your forehead. And he had me arrested again, you know, and I just, you know, I just had great ideas like that, you know, this will fix him. And, you know, I was just down in the dumps. I was a puddle, you know, and just was like, it's not going, Hank. I never had a job. I didn't know how to read. I didn't go to school. They gave me a diploma. They said, we'll give you a diploma if you don't come back. And, you know, and the only thing my mom wanted from me was, you know, get a diploma, graduate, you know. And I was hanging on by a hair, you know, just trying to keep myself in school. And so I agreed. I said, you know, no problem. But I really wanted to stay back because there were so many hot broads in my high school, man. It was rough stuff. And I thought, you know, if I leave high school, I have to get a job. I'll have to, you know, I won't see these girls anymore. But, you know, I just, I went up and lucked out and got into this treatment center and didn't hear a thing, unfortunately. I didn't listen to a thing. And I came out and one of, you know, this beautiful girl that I, you know, I really liked, asked, you know, I was just haunting her, you know, calling, come on, let's go out, come on, let's go out. We go to the Japanese steakhouse, which is this, like, Benihana kind of place, and we're eating, and I'm, you know, being the big shot, buying, you know, everybody in the goddamn restaurant booze and shots of Drambuie, and the next thing you know, somebody bought me a drink, and I was like, oops, didn't plan on that, you know, and I just said no, and I could only say no so many times, and I was drinking off the races. I woke up, my face on the front, you know, on the table. And you cook on the table in those places. And my face was in the table. I was passed out. The place was completely black. There was four, you know, the people, the Orient Asian people that were standing there waiting for me to wake up so they could drag me out. I wet my pants. The girl was gone. You know, I just was sitting there and, you know, Mr. Cool again, you know, like, you know, where am I? Did I tip you? You know, I'm broke. And it just, you know, and then my lawyer was like, you need help. And I accidentally went to treatment. Somebody there was telling the truth, and he told you what I just told you about my story. You know, I broke into houses. I attempted suicide. I've been to psych wards. I couldn't read. I couldn't write. I had no more friends. You know, my parents don't want me at home. I never had a real job in my life. You know, and I was like, man, this guy's never gonna get a girlfriend. You know, but what happened afterwards is people were talking to him and they weren't talking to me. And I was being cool in the back. You know, So the next day I rose my hand and I said, you know, I'm one too. And the good news is that from that moment forward, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous has worked on Bryce perfectly, just like it says it will in our book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And what's happened is that, you know, I couldn't stop drinking no matter what, no matter how hard I tried, no matter how much I put into it, no matter what I prayed, God, please help me. God, please don't let me get beat up. God, please don't let me shoot anybody. Please don't let me stab anybody. You know, just, you know, I had surrounded myself with what I wanted, and then it, like always, you know, it was completely out of control. And I thought if I surrounded myself with what I wanted, I would have control. And it doesn't work that way for me. And I ended up coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got the sponsor that I have by accident. My friend was in AA, and I said, who's your sponsor? And I said, what's a sponsor? And he said, don't worry about it. Go ask that guy. He's my sponsor. And so I went and asked him, and he's still my sponsor, you know. And I'm coming up on 23 years next 2 weeks from now. And, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, they said if I admitted that I was alcoholic and my life was unmanageable, that there was a possibility that I wouldn't have a drink that day if I kept coming back. So I did what they said, and it worked for me. I didn't have a drink that day, and my sponsor said, you know, well, let's try it again today. And he was easy with me, and he was a nice guy to me, and he never really, you know, he never gave me crap or never called me stupid or ignorant. You know, this guy loved me, and he loved me to sanity and loved me and taught me how to be friends with people instead of expecting friendships from people. You know, how to just show up and do my best instead of trying to show up and tell other people how to do their best for me. And, you know, that's where I came from. You know, it seemed like I was the guy, you know, I was, you know, what I was a mess. And what I wanted to be was just happy and usefully whole, like it said in the book. I wanted to have friends. And Billy, the guy that was next to me, was one of the guys that wouldn't hang out with me anymore because he was afraid I was going to kill him. And he wouldn't come over no matter how much money I stole or no matter who I, you know, what, nothing. He wouldn't hang out with me. And now he was willing to be a good friend of mine. And so there was a power in Alcoholics Anonymous that worked greater than myself. And that power is just the willingness to be with each other and the willingness to, for one alcoholic to help another. And when I first asked this guy to be my sponsor, I went to a restaurant with him. His name's Mike. He came here a while ago and spoke. And I went to a restaurant with him, and I told him, you know, and he said, why do you want to be sober? And I said, because I'm gonna die right now, you know, soon. I'm going to die. And I remember that like it happened yesterday, but I sure can't remember what I had for dinner. And, you know, and Mike put his hand on my shoulder. Now, I've been to prison, and men don't touch men. I didn't like it, you know, and I made sure that he knew that, but for that moment, it was okay. And he said, Bryce, if you come to Alcoholics Anonymous and you work and admit that you're powerless over alcohol and you go to meetings and your life's unmanageable, you can be restored to sanity. Now, everybody sitting here, you know, heard the insanity of a small part of my life. But I had lived 100 times more than that. And I knew that he was telling the truth, which is a miracle in itself. You know, I felt that he was telling the truth, and I believed him. And I haven't believed anybody in a long since my old man locked me in that room at 8 years old. You know, there was no telling the truth, and you know, it just wasn't going to happen. I had a 50-50 chance if I lied. And this guy told me the truth, and he told me that I could be restored to sanity, and it made me feel like, you know, like a light bulb, you know, dimmer switch. And the next thing you know, I was feeling good, and I believed him. And later on, you know, a couple days later, he said, you know, I want you to get your crap out of the house you're in, because I was in with an old girlfriend who was smoking dope and drinking, and it was just a matter of time before I was going to relapse. And he moved me into his house and helped with a living example of being restored to sanity. And he said, if I make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, that I will have someone besides myself that could stand between me and a drink. And you know what? I hated God. I mean, I blamed him for a lot of stuff I would say, and, you know, rawr, God, you know. But when he put it that way, and I thought he was making all this stuff up, you know, but when he put it that way, I said, okay, you know, okay, I'll believe in a power greater than myself. And it started out by being being people in meetings, because nobody here is going to lie to me about how to stay sober. Nobody, whether you like me or not, you know, nobody's going to lie to me about how to stay sober. So what happened was you became a power that was greater than me, because you could tell me the secret of staying sober when my mind was constantly telling me the solution was drinking. And so I had no way out, you know, without you. And so, you know, I made a decision, and that worked, and that has grown into, you know, God and the God of my understanding, you know, which is a miracle in itself, because my brother was a minister, and, you know, my parents used to make me go to church retreats where I got molested, you know, and got, you know, just a whole mess of crap. And, you know, none of which, you know, I can do anything about other than forgive. You know, because I'm sick. You know, when I drink, I get sick. And when other people drink, they get sick. And if I hold it against them, I got to hold it against me. And I just don't have any time or room to hate myself anymore when there's so much good that can happen here in AA. And they used to have a saying a long time ago, and it was, you know, the same person will drink again. And so, and that was always in connection with the four step. And in the four step, the list and the people and the opportunity that I was going to be able to make was just that. It was a four step. It was my inventory. And he didn't tell me about the fifth step. And since I couldn't read that well, you know, I wasn't going to go read a chapter ahead. But I had listened in meetings. And he said, right now all you're doing is a four step. Don't even worry about that. And, you know, and I just would, okay, you know, that's, I won't. You know, and I didn't. And I, you know, I did what it said in the book, you know, and I've done what it says in the book. And I brought it to him, and I shared it with him. And then I shared it with his sponsor. And then I shared it with somebody else I like, and a guy named Brother Alexis, you know, and I wanted feedback from, and I shared it with Brother Alexis because I hated the church so much, but I liked him. And I thought he could give me a good point of view from a place that I was not willing to go. And he did, and I love him for it. And Mike also said, you know, that I am entirely ready to have God remove the defects that are in my fourth and fifth step. And he said, start with the ones that you think will make you drink. You know, resentment, anger, you know, just wanting to get back at people. And that started to slowly work on me, where I had the opportunity to ask God to remove these defects of character and humbly ask him to remove my shortcomings. Because, you know, the greatest step for me, I'm a thief. I'm a liar. I'm a cheat. I hurt people intentionally because it makes me feel better. You know, when I drink and I hurt somebody, it takes away my pain a little bit. And luckily, it's been a long time since that happened, but I made a list of all persons I had harmed and became entirely willing to make amends to them all. And one day, based on God's wise decision and his intervention, I went into a deli, and I walked in, and there was about 16, 18 guys sitting at a table, and these are murderers and people just like me, you know, rough stuff. And I had been with my best friend, a guy who was dating my girlfriend, and he was sitting there, and I shot myself in his house. And when I was in the hospital, the FBI came in and said, you know, we want to know about this shooting. And I just, you know, F you, get out, I'll take care of it myself. What does that mean, Mr. McNaughton? I said, get out, you know, and that was it. And then when my friends came in, I said, Alan shot me, because I didn't want anybody to know that I was so insane that I was going to kill myself, you know. And now these guys liked me, and they liked him too, but when you're the guy that does the wrong thing, you know, you get to, you know, he was not treated nicely for a long time. And when I walked into this deli, you know, the first thing that came in my mind wasn't shoot, fight, run. It was, you know what, God, I'm going to put this one on you. I'm ready. Let's go. I became entirely willing to make direct amends. And I walked up to this guy, and I turned to the rest of them, and I told him that he didn't shoot me. I did it myself, and that I'm insane when I drink, and I apologize for putting him through that. And I went on and on, you know, not that too long, because they have an attention span like mine. But, you know, and And I just, you know, I said, you know, I just can't go where you guys are, but you can come where I am, and I'm sorry. And I left, and you know what? Every damn one of those guys has tried Alcoholics Anonymous, and the ones that left are dead, and the ones that are staying are still here. You know, and they have 20 years and, you know, 15 years and 18 years and 17 years. And, you know, they're all up there in the many, many, many years. A buddy of mine just drank. He had 18 years, you know, and he's the guy that tried to murder me because his brother came to me and asked if I would help him, you know, and he got sober and just drank recently. And, you know, there's nothing I can do about that except remain the same person or in the same place that I was when he saw me, you know, 18 years ago. And that's the best I can possibly do. You know, I don't can't go knocking on his door. I did call him, but, you know, he said, I'm not an alcoholic anymore. You know, we can see it, but I can't. You know, when it's my turn and I'm the one who's drinking, you know, I can't see any of that stuff, but you guys can. And there was a guy, and these guys are dead, Paul Raines and Chris Ryan, and these guys and myself. And when I got sober, it was the three of us that hung out in a group. I would lick the floors. I didn't give a crap. Pick up ashtrays. You could smoke back then. Chairs. Rub down the, you know, windows. Everything. I didn't care. We were there hours early, left hours late, cooking turkeys, doing everything. And one day, Chris came and to the meeting, and he was under arrest. And he said, you know, he drank. And he kicked his girlfriend's door down, beat the crap out of her, and put both her parents in the hospital. And this guy was a big guy, too. And I went to my sponsor, and another guy named Chris Paul Raines did the same thing, drank and went back out. And he murdered two people right around where the Rockville Metro used to be 20 years ago. And I went to my sponsor, and I said, look, what happened? We do the same thing. I see them every damn day. And he goes, they don't have a program, Bryce. And I was like, what are you talking about? You know, he goes, a program is what you do outside of a meeting. A program is not what you do so everybody can see who comes to the meeting. A program is something that you're doing outside of the meeting. Now, you know, and I was just like, wow. You know, I got to keep my ass right for me, not so my ego can go to court for people, you know. And the 11th step says, sought through prayer and meditation, and to increase the conscious contact with my higher power, and I do that. I pray and I meditate, and I really love what God has given me and done for me, and the people that He's put in my life, and the opportunity to come here and share and look at all you. It's funny, we pulled up to 7-Eleven just before we got here, and I saw two pretty girls, and I said to Jason, I said, you know, God, I hope there's girls at this meeting. Now there were so many, I'm distracted, but that's all right. It's watch what you pray for. And then we had a good laugh on the way here because there was this giant sign. It said, Labradoodles for sale. And I looked at him, and I said, what the hell is a mutt? That's a mutt for sale. And I said, we must be in the country. And So it made me laugh because I'm big into dogs. I have a good dog. And if anybody wants a dog, I need help. See me after the meeting. After having had a spiritual awakening, we have an opportunity to carry this message to alcoholics who still suffer. And the good news is that you can go anywhere. You know, you can go to hospitals, institutions, AA meetings, anywhere, high schools, anything, anytime, all the time. And, you know, it helps you stay alive. And I know that from my own experience because a year ago I was going through some rough time. You know, both my parents died. I lost a, you know, very, very big house, millions of dollars. I declared bankruptcy. This girl I was in love with, you know, I broke up with. And, you know, I mean, I was just ready to shoot myself in the head. And I called my sponsor, you know, and I was like, dude, you know, he said, come to the beach with me. And I said, look, it's a waste of time. And I was going to shoot myself in the head. You know, that was the only solution. I was feeling terrible. And he said, well, try God and try service, you know. And I was like, you know, and I just, you know, this came out of my mouth. And I said, I'm tired of it. You know, he said, no, you're not. You're just resisting it. So if you need help, stop resisting yourself. Because, you know, it's been a year. my birthday's on Thursday, and my anniversary is, 2 weeks. And, if I wasn't here, I wouldn't be here. And to me, that's a big deal because I'm really grateful to be with you alcoholics. I'm very grateful to have an opportunity to come out here. And I love the drive, and I love AA. Thanks so much.